Well, folks, we're back again with another week of Valley Edition. And I have before me three people who have been containing themselves. This is going to be a great day today. I can just tell. Terry Snyder, still gathering information as we speak. Zaz Hollander, who's come in from covering another story. And Mark Kelsey, coming in from the western reaches of the Valley. We're all here, and I'm going to start out with, I have to start out with the question of the day. What's your favorite brownie recipe? And can that be baked within the confines of the city of Wasilla?
You're going to have to use oregano in your brownies in the city of Wasilla.
Oregano.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't use pot.
Well, Zaz, you've stepped out there, so go ahead and speak a little bit more about this whole thing.
Well, Mike, that was a very clever way of getting into a discussion of Wasilla's city council on Monday night approved their new, what seemed to be the strictest marijuana regs locally that I've been able to find. And, you know, the headline is you can't make edibles in your own kitchen under this ordinance, under these regulations. Now you can consume pot brownies if someone makes them outside city limits and brings them in
and gives them to you, but doesn't sell them to you.
Correct. They can't be sold to you.
Right.
But so there are any number of what a few city council members express some concerns about, some privacy invasions in the new regulations. They also limit the amount of marijuana you can transport to 2 ounces per vehicle, where the state regs say everybody can have an ounce is the limit. So if you've got, there was a lot of conversation about party buses and what sounded kind of like clown cars. You know, what if there's 15 people in a van that's a pound of pot? The images were pretty amazing and amusing. These new regs are getting quite a bit of pushback from, as we were talking just before we went on air, from not only people who maybe wanted to make some brownies in their kitchen, but also simply object on principle, whether or not they are fans of pot brownies, object on principle to that kind of at least perceived, if not very real, invasion. There are a lot of questions about the enforceability of the new regs as well. You know, one of them says you can smoke marijuana on your private property or on private property with permission of the owner, provided it doesn't disturb your neighbor, at which point it must cease immediately.
So that's part of the ongoing discussion about a thing called public.
Exactly. This is how they got around the public requirements.
Right.
Or lack of definition there.
Now, Zaz has been very close to this topic, looking from a somewhat more distant location. Mark or Terry, do you have any comments?
Well, it's a head shaker to me. Zaz did a great job on that first story that's at ADN.com. There's some great reader comments after that story, too. We at the Frontiersman followed up a day or two after with a similar story, reporting the same stuff. But it's really a head shaker, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, one challenge is going to bring it down. It shows, in my mind, you know, some big-time thoughtlessness by elected people. As Zaz pointed out, especially the enforceability part of it. I mean, what are these people thinking? You know, I'm tempted to say, were these people high when they cooked this stuff up? Because it really is just outrageous. And coming from people who claim to be, you know, small government, you know, get out of our lives kind of people, these are the ones who are pushing it. They need to be called out by name. Stu Graham especially pushed it hard. And equally worthy of being called out by name, Colleen Sullivan Leonard and Brandon Wall, two people on the city council that really provided a voice of reason and tried to restore sanity to that whole proceeding, although they ended up in the minority, being voted down 4-2, but I'm sure we have not heard the last of this.
Okay, and of course, remind me, those of you more familiar with Wasilla, over there, if it had been 3-3, what would the mayor, have then had a role?
The mayor can choose to vote, and he, in fact, did. I didn't report this in the story, but there was one vote on on marijuana clubs and whether they should be illegal, I think. I'm sorry, I'm not getting it clear, but that was a 3-3. That was a tie.
And
the mayor voted in favor of regulating them so he could put it into the larger ordinance that everyone was voting on.
Okay. Okay. Terry, any comments?
Wow. Just wow. This is just typical of the knee-jerk reaction we're seeing just about in all corners, it seems, from a certain portion of the people, most notably the ones that didn't want this to go through in the first place, the voter initiative that sort of landed it on their lap. It should be said, you know, there's been plenty of time to bring it in a very thoughtful manner and regulate it on all levels of government, but they waited for the voters initiative and now they have to react, and they're sorely reacting not well, it doesn't sound like. I think it's just amazing that we sit here and this state and the cities and the boroughs have spent thousands of dollars on studies that tell them that the two leading factors that can harm the public they should do something about is smoking and alcoholism. Those are the two things. They have science that backs that up. They have no science that backs this up. The only science they really have is probably some international studies. So they're reacting to what's happened based on what's currently happening in other states that have regulated that are still flushing out all the things. And they're just reacting. And when government reacts without thoughtful discussion and starts bullying their way into regulations, it doesn't end well. And I think that's what it sounded like what happened on at Wasilla.
Well, and we'll move on in a moment, but the other interesting question that was discussed at great length in an article that I saw had to do with the question of what constitutes a household and the number of plants a household may have. These days, very often, you have people that are sharing a house. They may not have any connection to one another other than the fact that they're sharing a house. And as some interpretations have run, this means you get six plants, even if there are four people there. Other people would say, well, we're not related to these people. We happen to be sharing a house. We have rooms in this house. Should we not be allowed to have 24 plants in this house? And on and on. And the question of how to distinguish all of these seemingly simple guidelines still remains out there, and that's just another example that flows along the question of what is public, I think.
Well, and the gaps in the initiative language itself.
Yes, yeah, as the background reason. Yeah, that's where we are. Okay,
well,
go ahead.
One more quick point, if I may.
Sure.
This idea that people can't use a legal substance in their own kitchens to make brownies, for example, is no different than if the city council passed an ordinance telling people they can't brew beer at home anymore. Mm-hmm. Imagine the outcry, and it's the same thing. You have legal substances, and certainly with alcohol, the laws and general public thinking are based on a presumption that people can use this stuff responsibly. Why aren't we basing these pot laws on the same presumption? They seem to be coming from the exact opposite side of the spectrum, where we presume that people are morons and don't know how to conduct themselves and keep it away from their children and all those things. It's alarmist nonsense, in my opinion.
Well, and that's sort of was the basis of the campaign against this passing, was sort of a fear-based, the worst-case scenario of, you know, somewhat dubious facts that were brought, and the public didn't believe it. They didn't think that was going to be the case. And, you know, there's a little bit of poor loser going on, and there's a little bit of just overzealot people that just can't believe that this is something they've been told is bad for them all their life. I would like to note that it's gotten so serious that the alcohol board yesterday, or a couple of days ago, issued a release defining what public space was. And so it's an emergency order saying this is what public space is, because there's so much question going on in these communities about what defines public space. And they were pretty clear on what public space was, and it does not include inside of your kitchen. So they're going to have a lot to grapple with, and this is going to end up with very expensive, because lawyers are going to have a heyday, because when you start going against the intent of what the voters voted for, you're going down some pretty expensive pathways.
So one bright spot, of course, is the meditative stance that the city council in Palmer has taken. Mm-hmm. There was a this was a, a week where there were not a lot of governmental meetings. This was the city council met, certainly, but the borough and the school district did not meet this past week. But the city of Palmer City Council did meet. And they did not take up marijuana or regulation. Now, that's suggesting that there were some suggestions they would be looking at it in the future, but they're taking a measured approach. And that seems, in reflection, to be probably a wise thing to do, rather than to have to move forward and then pull back and to do all of this stuff. Well, let's move on from the local situation and move for a moment to look at Juneau, because yesterday, coming out of Juneau, was a whole spate, I like that word, spate of reports about hurry up and make things happen. We don't have to talk about it. We don't have time. Kind of summaries from subcommittees where presumably a lot of work is done. If you're looking at financing, particularly in education, which is a big issue, the heavy lifting very often is done early on in subcommittees, subcommittees of the House and over in the Senate, and then you move on to the bigger body, the Finance Committee. But as reported, there were a couple of subcommittees that basically seemed to be acting in concert, because the same statement was made and the same process or lack thereof was displayed. In other words, here's what we're going to send on. No, we're not taking any questions. Sorry, we don't have time. And they moved a piece, and the minority members would then come and say, but...
I got it 3 minutes ago.
Yeah, what's going on? I mean, this seems to be a departure from even some of the egregious examples of the past. What say you? Terry?
Yeah, well, not unexpected. You know, when you have power, it's fleeting, and there, you want to use it to the best of your ability, and that's exactly what's happening here. There's a certain ideology that has been embraced by the majority members of right now, and they're hurriedly getting that through. I will say that they can hurry it up to a point, but there will be some public process when it goes on to other committees. So keeping that in mind, it's time for people to find their voice. These small committees do make recommendations, and they do go to the larger committees and sort of moves on the adult line, as so I say, to, you know, as people look at it. Now, it is alarming that there is no public process. We should be very concerned about that. We should be even more concerned if there's no public process as it moves up the ladder. Because a lot of these things are done just for political statements. It's a way to appease the base. It's a way to get your own ideology and who elected you out there to say, I did it. Look, I tried to cut. And then once it gets up the ladder a little bit, people start really studying what the ramifications are. Now, having said that, I listened a little bit to House Finance on the Health and Social Services recommendations. Huge, huge, huge deep cuts there. And and you're right, it's sort of the same thing. Why doesn't Governor Walker give us a bill about Medicare? Why doesn't he introduce a bill? You know, it was commented, there was two bills last year languished and no one wanted to hear them.
And
there's one now they don't want to hear, but what they're saying is we want the right bill in front of us. So, you know, governing is messy.
Sure.
And it's not going to get any cleaner. And this is what we expected to happen for the next couple of years.
Right. And there's another aspect of this that warrants a little discussion. The legislature operates by spending money. They have staff, they have offices, they have all kinds of things they have to pay for, and that's reasonable. But I noted that, and I didn't see really this with much of an apology, a suggestion that the reduction that they were proposing in their own operational funds was considerably thinner than almost anywhere else.
It's laughable, especially while they're sitting there saying, oh, the governor should cut more than 5.8%. You know, we can cut deeper. And then they turn around and cut themselves by, what, 1.7% or something?
Yeah.
Token stuff that
and
means
pre-K.
Nothing.
And all of pre-K.
Yeah.
Oh.
And the STEM program,
which
is crazy. I mean people say it's crazy.
So I don't want to necessarily draw a direct connect the dots, one dot being in Wasilla in someone's kitchen cooking, baking brownies, but I just wonder, these don't seem to stand up to the straight-faced test. I mean, when you do these things, they seem to be not even making a good statement, if you have a statement of philosophy, but they just seem to be things that are, we suggest often, content for the Daily Show before it goes away. So let's bring this back home, though. There are two things that have occurred recently in the Valley since we've been wandering a bit. One has to do with not exactly a revolt, but expressions of concern dealing with a fire service area. Any comments about that? I know in particular Terry is familiar with that.
Zaz wrote a great story on it.
But Zaz has
I think Zaz should take the lead. She's
let's go.
You wrote a good story on that. Good insight.
Well, that's thanks for the compliment. They had a meeting I didn't attend in Willow last night. I figured that they'd rather not have my elementary age daughters whining about how late it was. But about 100 people I heard attended. Mayor DeVilbiss was there, and Mayor DeVilbiss appointed the Board of Supervisors. And so apparently there was some discussion of unappointing them. And the mayor, and this is at this point hearsay, I've heard it from a few people, basically said, no, they're gonna serve out their terms. They've been appointed and they're staying. You know, a lot of the attention that I've heard and reported focuses on the longest-term Board of Supervisors member, Doyle Holmes, who's a well-known, you know, former elected official. You know, this is his kind of position, long-time position there, and he's always a magnet for animated conversation. Let's put it that way. He doesn't shrink from criticism. He deals it out pretty good, and so that a number of people told me that he's kind of, if there's a long-standing conflict between the fire department and the board, it's a lot of it is coming and going from Doyle Holmes. But these are long-standing concerns that are kind of coming to a head at the fire department in Willow, where there's about 16 or 17 responders and a fairly new chief, Malin Green. And I think the combination of years of disgruntlement and a new chief and maybe some new perspective is leading this push from the firefighters who say, you know, the community doesn't realize what we are up against in terms of funding and our budget and the mill rate that this determines the taxes people pay for the fire service area. So the public is condemning the fire department for not responding to fires fast enough, say. Mm-hmm. The fire department is saying we don't have the resources to respond fast enough because our board isn't supporting us.
Okay. And
I think you outlined it pretty good about there was some trying to raise that mill rate in the past, and there hasn't gotten...
Yeah, and the community was not behind it.
Right, and, you know, just like any type of a raise in anything, just, I mean, there were a lot of people that didn't think a $214 million school bond would ever pass in the most conservative part of the state, but once a group of citizens got together and pointed out what the need was and really sort of campaigned for it, then people did it. So I'm wondering if that's where their stumbling block is. I'm not going to give any... I don't take any credit away from what you just said about Mr. Holmes, because I think he is sort of a community agitator there. But I do think that hopefully this will spur the conversation enough to have them put it back on the ballot and somebody take the helm of getting out and letting people know what they're sacrificing by not a little bit of money.
Well, and that's it exactly.
With already very low taxes out there.
Sounds like a big disconnect between what people want and what they're willing to pay for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not an uncommon dynamic, certainly.
Yeah. Well, and it's also indicative of the rural area where people have built out of pocket, so they don't have a mortgage, and they don't want to have insurance, and they don't want to pay for any extras, and they don't have the property values to draw off of. You know, in the Big Lake area, there's some really great big houses, and so they are able to, when they put a penny on their mill rate, they get a lot back. So... But when you get this far behind in your mill rate and you're unwilling to keep up with what your needs are, then it's a bigger chunk and it's a harder sell.
So would you say that this has any sort of canary in the coal mine effect, suggesting that there are other fire service areas that may be similarly moving in this direction of being somewhat underfunded or disgruntled?
There's certainly any number, I would think, would argue that they are underfunded, but in my limited reporting, this is the only fire service area that's kind of sparring with its own Board of Supervisors. That's
okay.
Dennis Brodigan all the way down to firefighters said they've never seen anything like that.
But the
before.
Whole emergency services question hasn't really been answered. They
right.
haven't answered the question of consolidated dispatch.
Right.
They haven't answered the question of They still have a lawsuit pending against them.
Yep, they have a class action lawsuit.
So this is symptomatic of a whole portion, I think, that is pretty unresolved, maybe not specifically a fire service area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you've said sparring, and that sparks a memory in my mind of the headline across the Frontiersman today that recounted the tale of a columnist who appears fairly regularly in the Frontiersman and has written significantly a number of books, etc., and is known somewhat as a philosopher, but was engaged in another activity when he found that someone had broken into his home. And so a gentleman, Charles Hayes, who had had his years in the Marine Corps and as a Dallas policeman, was brought right back to those days, I suspect, when he confronted an individual who had broken into his home, and he came face to face with one of his guns pointed at him, and he subsequently was able to pick up a shotgun and hold the person until the troopers arrived. It was a very, very, engaging story. We know Charles. He has appeared on the program here. Any comments about that whole process or anything? What does it say?
Well, it's definitely a great human interest story, a great story about, you know, a regular person, sort of regular person, okay? He's an ex-cop. That helps. Ex-Marine, that definitely helps. But it's a kind of story I suspect that people like to hear about, but it's also a story that could just as easily have been tragic.
Right.
So we are grateful, of course, for the happy ending, especially considering it's our friend Charles Hayes.
Well, I think the contrast to me was a responsible gun owner who, you know, was able to protect himself and what everybody, you know, hails as what we all have a right to. And then the young mother getting out of the car about a week ago and having the gun go off on her and shooting her own four-year-old. So I think the contrast to me stuck out there.
Okay. Zaz?
The car shooting, I think Terry makes a good point that you know, if you have any experience with gun safety and hunter safety, cars are among the most dangerous places to have your gun loaded, and a lot of accidents happen in your cars.
Right. Well, one last topic before we finish up. And that is the Iditarod, including the Junior Iditarod, seem to be going north very fast. The Junior Iditarod, which was scheduled to start more locally and moved further north, they haven't approached Barrow yet as a start. But there is good news in the sense that the Iron Dog participants have run into a lot of snow. And they started out sort of mud pits and the rest of it, but things have snowed up, and certainly snow has been reported in Nome, which is a very good thing. You at least have a race to the snow. And we wish them all well. This is a difficult race in any way, but if there's not enough snow or if you have treacherous conditions, because they run a lot on rivers, and when you get a little overflow, et cetera, this is not a good thing. So we wish all of them well. This is a tremendous, tremendous logistic issue, just moving all of people out and starting them up and all the rest of it. But right now, we continue to enjoy rather warm weather. So
it's supposed to get snow here this weekend, though.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then it's supposed to be in the 40s again.
Right, so we can enjoy the snow. So to speak. Well, thank you again. I want to thank Mark Kelsey from the Frontiersman. I want to thank Zaz Hollander from the Alaska Dispatch News. And I want to thank Terry Snyder from all the rest of the world that isn't covered by those other two. So we'll see you next week. Bye.